This episode of the Memory Palace is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit Progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. The story was already familiar by the time the passengers could see the lights off Miami Beach. The first article about the St. Louis, an ocean liner owned by the Hamburg America Line, and the more than 900 refugees it bore, appeared in American papers in May of 1939, not long after the ship left Germany for Cuba. The Cuban papers had the story weeks before. Its right-wing press had been warning about an invasion, had printed the same sorts of anti-Semitic screeds and cartoons that had been weaponized by the German state, whose program of terror just the previous year alone had burned synagogues, had looted Jewish homes, invalidated Jewish passports, closed all Jewish-owned businesses, forced Jewish men and women to change their names, removed their children from German schools, stripped German Jews of the right to own property, the right to rent property, which served to lay the groundwork for their imminent forced removal. They had already built a handful of concentration camps, including Buchenwald, and were already killing Jews there, and dissidents, and homosexuals, and disabled people, and African Germans too. But the Reich had not yet industrialized the process. Did it with forced labor and beatings and pistols and firing squads. Heinrich Himmler hadn't yet mechanized the process for maximum efficiency in order to protect German soldiers from the mental toll of having to kill people one by one. People knew those stories. Many thousands of Cubans applauded them, rallied in Havana against the looming arrival of the St. Louis, cheered as a spokesman for the country's former president pledged to fight the Jews until the last one was driven out. The more sober press didn't focus on the Jews. They weren't anti-refugee. Of course not. They were pro-Cuba. The island was still mired in the Great Depression, and it was a small island with a tight job market. And setting aside jobs for the moment, if the state allowed a sudden influx of any population, setting the Jewish question aside for the moment, any population who didn't speak the language, didn't share its customs and traditions, would that not change the character of Cuba? That story was familiar to Americans who had been following how its own government had spent recent months debating marginal adjustments to existing immigration quotas. Refugees were constantly in the news. Everyone knew someone would have to do something. War was coming. Maybe not to America, but Europe was on the brink. There would be more refugees, maybe millions looking for safety. And then after safety, jobs, social services. And this was 1939, and America too wasn't entirely out of the Depression, and setting sympathy aside, and who wasn't sympathetic? Americans are a sympathetic people. There were practical considerations. Economics. America's national character. And though they didn't know what was coming for the Jews of Europe, they knew there was a case to be made for accepting more. So the papers were filled with stories about the progress of various committees and commissions. A senator from New York and a congresswoman from Massachusetts had a bill that would allow 20,000 German Jewish children to immigrate to the United States. That was in the news all the time. The big editorial boards came out in favor of it, prominent churches, but it got saddled with amendment after amendment in the House, and then it got blocked from even reaching the Senate floor by a North Carolina Democrat, who was an avowed anti-Semite, but who was also a key vote that FDR knew he'd need for the war effort ahead, so Roosevelt never pushed for it. But there was the sense that things were happening, that all the politicking and the horse trading and the trial balloon floating would add up to something. It was sort of abstract at that point, and easy to lose the thread. There was just so much in the news all the time. But the St. Louis wasn't an abstraction. 900 people on a boat, the average reader could get their head around that. There was a drama playing out in the paper, a new development each day. These were characters, real people, with clear motivations and the highest of stakes. And there was a natural story arc built into the journey, characters with a purpose and a destination and questions hanging over it all. Would these people arrive? Would they, to put it plainly, survive? So everyone knew about the St. Louis. Followed it as Cuba rejected all but a handful of its passengers. Followed the subplot of a New York lawyer sent from an American Jewish organization to lobby Havana to accept their visas. Almost all the refugees had them in hand. They read about each twist in the story, about how when this lawyer's plans were rejected, he tried to get Cuba to agree to put them in what everyone called a concentration camp, a temporary holding facility. A place for them to stay apart from the general population while they applied for asylum, while their permanent status was resolved. They read about how the government demanded more than $430,000 to do so, to cover the cost of the refugees' care, to keep them from being a drain on the average Cuban, and how the lawyer asked for more time, and how he eventually came up with $500,000, had it sitting in an escrow account at Chase Bank in Manhattan. But the Cuban government said it was too late. Then stories came out about two other boats set to follow the St. Louis to Havana, but were turned back toward Germany. Stories of failed attempts to place the refugees in Mexico and the Dominican Republic. And other stories about other refugees being turned away from Ecuador and Costa Rica. It was hard to keep it all straight. They read about how relatives of the passengers who made their own way to Havana, a man who brought an engagement ring from New York to give to his fiancée when she got off the boat, of all the people who'd hired boats in the marina and brought them alongside the St. Louis to get close to their families and friends that they'd hoped to save, but who instead stayed on the decks of the ship shouting down to their relatives from the rail, close enough to talk to, close enough to be heard sobbing over the idling engines, the slap of the waves in the hull, close enough to see a father of two leap from the ship and see the blue water purple with the blood from the slits in his wrist. Watch him flail as he tried to will himself to drown before he was pulled ashore. The American papers were sympathetic. The American people were sympathetic. They are a sympathetic people. But few papers called on their government to take the refugees in. The president didn't respond to a cable sent directly by passengers on the St. Louis asking for him to intervene personally. An official from the State Department pointed out that if they let these 900 German Jews in, they were going to have to lower the scheduled quota by 900 other German Jews, and those people were already in the queue. It was pointed out that FDR could have issued an executive order, but after getting slapped back by isolationist Republicans during the midterm elections, and with his own re-election bid around the corner, the president wasn't prepared to spend his political capital saving the people on the St. Louis. Instead, the federal government sent a Coast Guard patrol boat to sidle up to the ship when it sat just 3 miles offshore from Miami Beach, just in case anyone got any ideas about jumping in and swimming for shore. Everyone knew. They read about it and worried. Wished there was something more they could do, nodded gravely as they read the Washington Post plea for sympathy for the plight of the passengers, though the editorial did not call on the United States to take them in. Just laid the blame on the shipping company, who should have made sure the Cubans would take them in before they took off across the Atlantic. In the German government, were the Hitler regime, the editorial board wrote, were the Hitler regime more generous in the treatment of the unwanted element of its population, they would not be forced to flee as frequently as they are. And so the St. Louis returned to Europe. The final articles, the end of the story everyone had followed so closely, were datelined Antwerp. German Jewish organizations had negotiated to send them to 4 different countries, some to Great Britain, some to the Netherlands, some temporarily to France, some were allowed to stay there in Belgium. A few years ago, you might have heard this story before, the Holocaust Museum in Washington undertook a massive project to determine what happened to the passengers at the St. Louis. They found that all of them who were sent to England survived the war, except one who was killed in an air raid in 1940. But nearly all who found refuge on the continent were trapped and were sent to camps. 278 of those people survived the Holocaust. 254 did not, because the boat was turned back, because the politics of the day were challenging and complicated, and refugees were caught in the middle. But you are familiar with that already. This episode of the Memory Palace is produced and written and stuff by me, Nate DeMeo, with engineering assistance from Elizabeth Aubert and research assistance from Eliza McGraw. We get ad music from J.D. Sampson. This show is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a collective of independently produced podcasts owned and operated without undue influence of venture capitalists or corporate bean counters. Find out more about Radiotopia and about the shows in the family at radiotopia.fm. You can follow me at The Memory Palace on Twitter and on Facebook. You can write to me at nate@thememorypalace.us. And at thememorypalace.us, you can go to /events and find out about live shows that I'm going to be doing here in the fall of 2019. To celebrate the show's 10th anniversary, I've just announced the first three of those, actually first four, three cities, four shows. In New York at the Bell House, two at the Rochester Fringe Festival, and one in Philadelphia, starting on September 18th. Go to thememorypalace.us/events, and you can find links for tickets, and there will be more shows announced, some in the Midwest, some in the West Coast, some in the Mountain West, maybe some in the South, as the year goes on. Thanks.
Radiotopia.